This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
This morning, and welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You are on the clock with Erin Green. I can't even remember what day it is. How many days have we been on vacation, Mark?
Plenty days.
But listen, this is 19th of April. We're now in the seventh and a half week of April. I am so glad to be out of the holiday fugue. Good morning, Bahamas. Good morning. If you hear this frog in my throat, it's because of the Because He Lives Kingdom Rush. It's not that I made it to the Rush, you know. It's that I spent the whole night trying to find out where the Rush was. Searching for the Junkanoo music. At least that's what I tell my mommy when I was out the house. I had to go find this good Junkanoo music. I know the Junkanoo community is, you know, very, very happy. Very, very happy. The Because He Lives Kingdom Celebration Community Rush returned to the streets of New Providence yesterday morning following a two-year hiatus due to the COVID-19 pandemic protocols. Junkanoo enthusiasts danced and joined in with the band as they rushed along the route from Wolf Road to Christie Park on Nassau Street in the early hours of Easter Monday morning. Good morning to the Junkanoo community. I hope that we are on the road to Bay, and every parade, every event, you know, is an opportunity for us to show each other, prove to ourselves that we can do this thing. We can manage the protocols, we can manage the logistics, and we can ensure equal and equitable participation. Like, that's the most important thing, right? Last week we talked about cultural retention and cultural loss leading into the holiday weekend. And we have to take concerted efforts to ensure that everyone can hold on to the train, right, as we drive forward. And that's very, very important. Good morning, Junkanoo community. And on that note, I have just a small note in the papers. This week, we're going to talk about it tomorrow, I think.
This virtual Junkanoo?
Right, Grand Bahama. Yeah. Grand Bahama got their seed money. Virtual Junkanoo is set for May 7th. But the Ginger Moxie, the minister for Grand Bahama, is hoping that they can organize a hybrid parade where they can have some real-time activities. So 10 groups will be getting seed money in Grand Bahama, and that's good. That's good. But we can talk about that a little bit later. It is a World News Tuesday, and there's lots in the news. First of all, we want to say congratulations to Jamaica for winning CARIFTA for the 175th time. Right? Say congratulations. Good on you, old man. We're not denying any of the successes, any of the journeys, you know. We just want to say, though, I feel like with 400,000 people competing against Jamaica, and now that we are employing more effective strategies, the Bahamas' performance is certainly worth celebrating. And not knocking anything off of Jamaica's first place, I think our second place is a tremendous success.
Because we have one-tenth of the population, right?
So, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And the archipelagic nature of the country, I mean, even juxtaposed to the terrain that Jamaica deals with, the mountains also cause similar but not exactly the same sort of obstacles and barriers for equitable access and participation. But we are certainly proving ourselves to be a powerhouse in track and field. And several people have asked me informally, you know, this performance at Charifta would suggest to them that maybe track and field should be our national sport, right?
Mm-hmm.
And comparing, so track and field and basketball to sailing, right? It's worth consideration, definitely worth consideration. But congratulations to the Bahamian track and field team for coming second at the track, Charifta, and the Bahamas swim team. We're congratulating them. The event's not over yet, but it seems as if they have a comfortable lead. It seems as if they have a comfortable lead, but we don't want to, you know, we're not dissing any of the other participants. These guys are strong swimmers. They could, you know, they could come back. I don't know if any of them ever swim from Nassau to Anderson. I had a boyfriend, and he and his brother were track athletes. So his brother was an athlete, got a scholarship in the U.S. running track, and he explained to me that they had no car, they had no bicycles. So when they wanted to see their girlfriends or young women they were interested in, they essentially had to foot it. They had to jog or run anywhere they went. And these guys also, I am almost certain, began swimming from Andrus to New Providence daily to look for a wife, right? So they can't beat us, but they could put up a good fight. Absolutely.
They couldn't find a good woman in Congo Town, eh?
Well, no, it's not that. I think they may have been related to everybody in Congo Town. They're good women.
Yeah.
Just not eligible for marriage.
So what about the 50th anniversary in Charifta? Because that's a big story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Did we win that? I believe we did.
I think we won the bid.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bahamian government won the bid.
Yes.
Right? Bahamian athletes, and say they won the bid. The Bahamian people, they're wondering, where's the money coming from? I'm very concerned. Because I saw some speculation that the government is hoping to host three grand international sporting events in the 50th celebration year.
What are the other two? Can you remember?
Well, I know that they've put in a bid, but what I've read is that they've put in a bid to be the permanent host of the IAAFs. Now, I'm waiting for that to be confirmed. Like, you got to see it three or four times for it to be confirmed, and you got to wait till the Prime Minister says it.
Okay.
For complete confirmation. Right? In fact, there's a formula like Nintendo. It's like Clint PM. Clint PM, Minister of Sports, Clint PM, and then you know it's confirmed. But top that, the money that we're going to spend for the 50th celebration, then the Bahama Games, right? And then Charifta. And then the potential for other events. And so I have this very big concern, right? I have this concern that we sort of relegate Bahama Games, we divert resources. And I hope that we see the Bahama Games as an integral part of nation building, cultural retention, and especially necessary in a country with an archipelagic exterior, you know, where we're so far flung from each other. Because we're going to need the resources to ensure equitable access.
I mean, where do the athletes come from? Are they all from Nassau, the successful ones? Because we've had athletes from the Family Islands. I remember there's a high jumper from Freeport.
In fact, when you do a breakdown, I think there's an equal spread, right? Mm-hmm. Where young athletes are coming to New Providence.
And then they go to SAC. And the rest is history, right?
There you go. Well, look here, Sack, we want to thank you for supporting athletics in the country, right? We can throw shade later. When you do a breakdown, like we talked about Matthew Matau. He's from, I think, Abaco. Mm-hmm. A number of our runners are from Northern Islands, Abaco, Bimini, Moores Island, the Keys in particular. And I wonder if that's because you gotta catch that boat. You can't let that boat leave. You can't miss that boat. You gotta make sure somebody could catch that boat, right? Maybe that's why it's a matter of necessity, inherently built in. But I'm looking forward to it. I wonder if ultimately, like what we're seeing is everything is about tourism though, right? Like, and this is it. I'm hoping that we don't focus all of our energies on the external people and the external gaze and the external impact. That we host these things and we balance that the need and the potential, right, of drawing international revenue, international investment, and something grander than that, which is relationship building, right? A commitment, an international commitment to participation with the Bahamas. And we balance that with providing opportunities for Bahamians to not just equitable access, but real participation in the space, not just the activity, but in the space generally. And there has to be like a quid pro quo. I haven't watched Law and Order in about 25. That's like the sentence of life. Eh? In about 25 years, I haven't watched Law and Order, but a quid pro quo where, listen, we're going to give you concessions. We even are going to let you do things that we don't let our own citizens do. But we expect a payback, right? There has to be a commensurate exchange for that.
So do these things make money? That's my question, like Karifta. You know, in the past, yeah. Olympics was like a gold mine. You would make, you know, $1 billion or something like that for the country. But then I think the last Olympics, they didn't make any money.
Right. Well, Olympics don't make money. Yeah. And I want to say they don't make monies. And to the point where I think it's a political strategy to destabilize advancing nations by making them host an Olympic, right? But it's sort of like I like to call the anti-imperialist game here. You can't fight mega resorts. You have to figure out how to benefit advantageously while protecting the entire environment, right? Remembering that they exist in your environment. So any negative harm to them is negative harm to you. I think that's how we win from these. So we're not going to make money from hosting a baseball tournament at the new stadium. But we can make money if we make the stadium available for other countries in the region to train, to practice, and to host their own tournaments, and they pay to use this space. Mm-hmm. We can also make it regional in the U.S., right? And maybe like U.S. Puerto Rico games played in Puerto Rico and the Bahamas. And that's how I think we're going to have to...
So in order to do that, you need to advertise the successful games, right?
Right.
To get to there.
And you need to build a culture. You need to build a spectator culture around the games as well. You need to be able to drive in spectators. And that's where you make the money. You want people to be planning to come spend their vacation in the Bahamas for this event 2 years in advance. You want companies to begin putting these events on their corporate calendars, their retreat calendars. Listen, as a bonus this year, we take in the whole department to the Bahamas to go watch the so-and-so bowl, to go watch U.S. players play other U.S. players in this, right? Mm-hmm. And so it takes a lot of work and participation from your cultural stakeholders. They got to be walking step in step with you to build out this vision. And more importantly for me, you got to do that because you have to convince the Bahamian people why we giving you this money. Is it just for politicians to look good, right? Is it just for us to produce 1 out of 100 athletes? Now, when we start producing 20 out of 100 athletes, then we're talking the money. But how do you convince us to give you the money to look good in that external community?
So what would be good would be like a cost-benefit analysis where you could just discuss all the benefits, the costs, and that would also drive the strategy, like you're saying, which is focusing it to be more beneficial long-term, right?
Right, and we could see it as a part of a larger strategy because the two other things that that happened and are about to happen, right, that make me think with a savvy, the right perspective, a savvy tourism team is building various tourism portfolios. For instance, I saw this thing, it just is floating around, that the gaming board executives and the Gaming Operators Association were all in London last week. And I said, well, what y'all doing in London? And y'all ain't call nobody, y'all ain't tell nobody. Now, they told one person, right?
Who was that?
Well, apparently they told Oswald Brown. Okay. Because if Oswald Brown's story is the only story I see out there in both the Bahamas Chronicle and BahamasUncensored.com, right? Covering this trip. Now, it's not nefarious, right? The gaming board executives and members of the Gaming Operators Association were in London for the ICE, for ICE, which is like the... Man, Mark, I have it written down here in my notes.
International something.
Yeah. It is the International Casino Exposition held in London, right? And I thought, okay, maybe you should tell us you're going to London. I'd ask you to bring me something back, you know. But it's a good thing. They're going to sit with industry leaders and decision makers, policy makers, to look at the, you know, cutting edge innovation in the industry, developments coming out of the pandemic. And I imagine this is a great space for Bahamian gaming operators and a necessary space for Bahamian executives to be in, because the pandemic would have spurred an exponential increase in online gaming, right?
Yeah.
And online gaming is where I imagine our local gaming operators are focusing their energy because of the limited market that the Bahamas provides for them, considering they're not allowed to tap into the tourist market, right? And so we don't want them to limit their profit-making ventures to the Bahamas. If they could go out into the world and make profits that will benefit the Bahamas, I am all for that. We are all for that in a healthy way, like in a good way, though, right? Like, don't imperialist these people to pieces. You know, let's make a healthy revenue. But I also concerned because, like, it's like you're going to make these decisions without us again. And when will Bahamians be involved truly in the consultation process for these things, you know? But I hope they also went to go find out if they could host a conference like that themselves, right? If we have the capacity to do that. And so I hope that conference tourism is also something that we're looking at, but in a way that benefits Bahamians and not this trickle-down economics y'all keep talking about, because politicians' pockets don't have any holes, apparently. Nothing ever trickles out. It's the weirdest...
That was a misnomer, but trickle down. It was actually trickle up.
Yeah.
If we look at, you know, when Trump did that big tax cut, there was no benefit. You know, I think it was the Yale report showed there was no benefit to the economy at all. It just went into assets, you know, and boosted the stock market.
Yeah. I think about the package, the financial package that Ukraine received recently. And... to support the continuation of business, of governance and business mainly. And apparently what they did was they privatized a whole bunch of enterprise, state enterprise, you know? And I hope that, I hope that the aid actually impacts the citizen on the ground and not just the, what they call it, the corporatocracy, not just the corporations and the money makers.
I mean, the thing that worries me about that is always the strings attached, right? When you get aid or when you get some loans and things, for example, from the IMF, there will always be strings attached. And if you go back to Ukraine, that was the initial situation when they had that coup back in 2014, because when they were offered the loans, they had a lot of strings attached, which, you know, the usual ones that they had to privatize, they had to have a situation where people didn't have money, would close the economy down, and there was just too much for them to take. And and so they refused that package, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
It looked good, didn't it, on the paper, on the surface. But when you look below the surface, you know, it's a completely different thing.
Yeah. You all borrowed money from your mummy before. You all understand how these... I mean, like, sometimes we think they're so far away from us. We're so removed from that, you know, that level of policy making. But you borrowed money from a older family member before, or they've borrowed money from you and to try to change the terms on you, you know, midway through the deal. so you understand these things. I got a text here. I got to read this one. Michael's name is pronounced Matthew. Matthew, the French derivation has a little more flavor, but it basically sounds like Matthew. Bahamians say Matthew, actually pretty close to the French. So it's Michael Matthew. Okay, is that it? It's Michael Matthew? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I didn't think it. But thank you. Yeah. So when we pronounce Matthew, we put a little French flair on it, but Matthew. Okay, I got you. Thank you, texter. I got another text here. Is it true that that Chris Brown, the singer, is a Bahamian and lived in Eleuthera, and there's a road named after him, and that he used to run, and that is how he got to leave to go live in the States? Because if that is true, that would be awesome. My family is from Eleuthera. Arlington, you send me that text? That's you, hey, producer. You send me that text, hey? Dear Texas, I want to thank you very much for inspiring this small, small history lesson. Okay, so there are two very famous Chris Browns in the world. One is a singer and dancer, and unfortunately is renowned to be a maybe reformed domestic abuser. The other is a world-renowned Bahamian athlete. Mm-hmm. And trainer, and this is sports, I would say stakeholder now. He's gone beyond just being an athlete. Chris Brown is, I think he's from Eleuthera. He did have a road named after him, and you should be proud because it is awesome, and your family is from Eleuthera. That makes it even more awesome. Like, there's nothing mm-hmm. to be ashamed of, but that is not the boy who is moonwalk and like, we like him. We only like him because he's due to Michael Jackson, you know. I mean, the boy is a little talented, but we have to also deal with that issue where he did that, you know, horrible thing, physical violence to Rihanna. And we got to reconcile with that. And I don't know if I reconcile with it. You catch me off guard. I go on to diss the brother, but I got to be more polite than that. I got another text here that says, hey, Aaron, another homosexual was killed due to suspected domestic violence. What do you have to say about the burgeoning levels of violence within the gay community? Burgeoning levels of violence within the gay community. I mean, I've talked repeatedly about violence within the gay community and violence towards the gay community repeatedly over the years. I don't want you to suggest it is something that I don't talk about. I also talk about the fact that vulnerable and marginalized communities have less access to the types of support services that those people we call normal have. So it's more difficult for a gay couple to find counseling because the church is not really offering counseling to gay couples. State services, while there are tons of professionals in the state services, and even in private service, we got tons of professionals. We got a sort of a cultural barrier where sometimes, like, the most professional therapist will tell you up front, I am uncomfortable in this space. I am not sure if I am the right therapist for you. The most professional therapist will come up and say that out front, but some can't. And some feel like they do, and some feel like they're doing the right thing. And that they're solving your problem by showing you that your orientation, your commitment to this orientation is incorrect, and that's where your problem lies, right? And so you're going to see what looks like greater instances or more instances, larger, trying to do that verb thing, that grammar thing there, of violence in the community. But sometimes what we're seeing is the fact that there are less options available for conflict mm-hmm. resolution, right? It's more difficult. Like, if I live with my partner because my family have abandoned me or kicked me out, then it's more difficult for me to find a safe space to leave the house in times of conflict, right? As well. But at the same time, texter, I want to say good morning to Candy Gibson from Foam mm-hmm. because Candy Gibson reached out to me yesterday and said, hey, Ms. Green, are you ready to do a press conference? I say, man, Candy, I appreciate your commitment. I can say it now in case I didn't say it clearly enough on the voice note. I appreciate your commitment, but I don't know if I am, A, the right person to do a press conference, and if, B, if a press conference is necessary for this particular event. I can tell you why. Because it didn't have nothing to do with that song I played this morning called Normal, you know. What was normal is that it's like this violence has been normalized, and what we expect our children to live through is normal, right? While we ignore that it's happening. But if it is a case of domestic violence, it's being alleged that it's a case of domestic violence, right? Then this is not abnormal, right? We've seen a rise in domestic violence. We've seen a rise in the type of violence, right? The aggression attached to it. Will I say this is the first time I am hearing about woman-on-woman violence within the queer community? No. This is not the first act, if this is what it is. It's not the first act. It's not the first time we're hearing it. Is it the first time I'm hearing about a queer woman shooting another queer woman? I think so. Right? But I don't want to normalize it, but I also don't want to make it seem like this is somehow more sensational than the violence that is occurring between heterosexual people, mm-hmm. like in terms of domestic violence and intimate partner violence, or that it's more sensational than the gang violence. Now, it is femicide, right? It is the killing of a woman, and if it is the domestic violence as it's alleged, right? The idea that you do it because it's a woman and a woman shouldn't engage you that way, right? You deserve that. You shouldn't be acting that way towards me, But it is femicide.
Well, it's interesting. You know, if you look at the data from the States, you know, one of the big arguments for gun control and more gun safety is because women are disproportionately the victims of these homicides. In fact, looking at some statistics here, that a woman's risk of being murdered increases 500% if a gun is present during a domestic dispute. Mm-hmm. So it could have been, you know, two women having a domestic dispute, but somehow one of them had access to a gun. And the rest is history. And in the States, women are 11.4 times more likely to be the victims of gun homicides.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're looking at it from a women's perspective. There's a lot to fear, you know, for when you look at the data.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so it.
And there were, you know, something like 3/4 of the women that were killed were from an intimate partner or somebody, either an intimate partner or somebody that they knew who was stalking them or an abuser, you know, some abuser that they knew.
Yeah.
So that's why it's so dangerous to have these guns around, you know, particularly for if you're a woman.
Right.
So it's much more dangerous for you.
And you referenced an article last time you were here.
Yeah.
Right? So I pulled it up. And it's Gun Ownership in the Bahamas is the chapter that you were referencing in a larger volume called Violence in the Bahamas, right? Mm-hmm. And it... two conversations that struck me was why was the person in possession of the gun in possession of the gun? Like the reason for having it, right?
Do we know what kind of gun it was? Was it a shotgun or a...
Well, they talk about all the types of guns, right? But they talk
I'm talking about the femicide that happened.
I'm not sure. I think it was a handgun, but I'm not sure. I'm not certain at all.
Because, you know, there's very little data on handguns. Most of our data is on shotguns and rifles.
Right, because you...
Technically, you have to get a special license to get a handgun.
Right. Well, first of all, you have to get a license, right, to get a shotgun or a rifle. It's not just automatic.
And it's for hunting.
Right, and it is specifically for hunting.
Hunting, right.
Right, the legislation says that, the application says that... And you essentially commit to that, right?
See, what was interesting about that article, it made a few points. I'll sort of just try to remember the main points. So the first one was that the idea that having more guns would make you feel safer is actually just a belief.
Yeah.
It isn't actually backed up by data. And talking about rifles and shotgun also made the point that the purpose for which there was a disconnect with the purpose with which people purportedly owned their guns for hunting and what they actually intended to use it
right.
for.
And what they were willing to say they were going to use
right.
it for.
Because when
right?
I was a kid, you know, the neighbors down my neighborhood would say, you know, if somebody come in my house, I'm going to pop them with this rifle. You know, it was a hunting rifle, but they openly said that they would use it for protection, right?
Right. And so yeah. that's the part that I wanted to get to, especially linking it to the femicide, right? Because in this conversation on social media last week, week before last, about gun ownership, and I'm saying, listen, I don't know if we are ready for what I call like common carry, and they were calling concealed carry, where you could have a handgun mm-hmm. and you could move about yeah. with it. I said, I don't think we're ready for it. I don't think collectively we have the temperament for it. But to the point about femicides, right, and the concern about gun ownership, there's so many people in the Bahamas that have guns, shotguns, and rifles for hunting, but clearly they have it for protection. And they don't have a problem saying they have it for protection. Like, they don't have a problem saying, look here, they say, you know, I have this for protection. And I know so many people, well, I've heard of and talked when I was much younger, surprised by so many people who say they travel with their gun, their shotgun, for protection and pretend like, oh, I went hunting today or I go in hunting in the morning and just in the car. And so to link that to the femicide discussion, like, I don't know how comfortable I would be with a gun in the house if you so easy to say it's for hunting and I know it ain't for hunting. Like the same way you would use it to shoot a perpetrator and say, hey, I mean, it's for hunting, but they came in my house and I had a gun. It's the same way you could say she attacked me. She threatened to attack me. Or I thought she was a perpetrator. I thought she was, you know, she had broken in and I mistakenly shot her.
Well, all the data says more guns, more violence, more gun violence.
Yeah.
There's a direct correlation between the two. But we have this kind of feeling that, okay, if we have some, somehow we'll be safer. But the data doesn't actually show that. Or, well, the data up to 2016 doesn't show that. Because they always said, you know, one of the things is, you know, the good guys with the gun can stop a bad guy. So we have this idea that we can, you know, be like a Rambo, you know, somebody, you know, intervene. And they found the data was only 1.3%. of gun shootings were used for that purpose. So it's statistically insignificant, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so we still have these perceptions that the more guns, we're going to feel safer, but it actually is not borne out by data.
Yeah, not at all.
If you look at, I mean, Australia was a good example when they banned guns. I forget what type it was. I think it was the machine gun type, and then their mass shootings completely disappeared.
Yeah.
And so just on that basis alone.
Yeah, and so for me, I wonder, are we locally, are we culturally ready?
Yeah.
Are we culturally ready?
And I don't know if we are, because unless we think we're the 51st state.
Yeah.
And which we could be.
But I think a lot of it is ontological Americanness.
Yeah.
And we forget that we're not American, you know,
right,
and not born out of the same experiences.
But think of the cultural influences. We right. could almost be Americans, right?
I mean, we practically are.
Yeah.
You know, except for
my
law.
Friends would cuss me if I said that, but, you know.
Look here, my ancestors cussing me right now, Mark. Anyway, you hear that music? We got to go to a break. I'm sorry we took so long to get to a break. Producer, stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Aaron Green and Mark Palmer, we'll be right back.
We used to get paid in little brown envelopes. Now they're debit cards, credit cards, digital money. If you're feeling overwhelmed and want to know more, the Central Bank and financial experts will be on radio talk shows from April 25th through 29th to explain topics like, can I really do without cash? Is my digital money safe? What's happening with the credit bureau?
How can I access and use sand dollars?
So listen into your favorite radio station all week for these and other topics, or visit www.getmoneysmartbahamas.com to learn more.
The city of Miami is waiting for you, and Island Pay wants to take you there. Yes, you heard that correctly. Island Pay is giving away 5 priceless trips to Miami for 2 people just for using your MasterCard prepaid card. Every $30 you spend gets you a chance to win. Whether it's on groceries, gas, diapers, clothes, gifts, online, and others, it's all counting and getting you closer to an unforgettable experience in Miami. Don't have an Island Pay MasterCard yet? No problem. Get yours today. And Island Pay will give you $15 back. Island Pay, a better way to pay, a better way to win. Promotion running March 21st to May 18th, 2022. Conditions apply. Visit islandpay.com to learn more.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Tell me what it was for, what's the big deal? Just a few black boys with some blue steel, running round in circles just to get a square meal. But as a normal seed, let's just keep it real, cause everybody's selling keys. Normal, normal. I know they're busting that police. Normal, normal.
Good morning, welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You're on the clock with Aaron Green and Mark Palmer this morning. We're talking a bit of world news and bringing it back to the Bahamas. You know, another topic I had, I'm not going away from the gun topic, mm-hmm. right? But another topic I had was the mask mandates, oh, yeah. right? And I think both conversations are similar. It's, you know, one of the things that we're interrogating is the balance of individual and collective rights and responsibilities, right? And like one of the questions I want to ask is, can we not have guns because the collective is, because an individual has messed it up for the collective, or, right, the irresponsible individual has messed it up for the responsible collective, or has a irresponsible collective messed it up for responsible individuals, right? And so the mask conversation, the gun conversation, and even the cannabis conversation. There's an article where three men were arrested for possession of drugs in Abaco, right? And I think all of them have a similar thread of...
They're similar, but slightly different mm-hmm. In terms of... So actually, I've just lost my train of thought. I'll have to come back to it. My phone just went, sorry.
No problem. So for me, right, the gun issue, I remember being young and hearing anecdotal, right? Oh, listen, the police tell us, you know, after the break-in, they say, listen, miss, you in this house with just women, you know, or it's just you and this young boy in this house. You, if you come in, you shoot them and drag them inside the house, you know, because that's the law. If they're in the house, you could do it. And there's a desire by police to ensure that people can remain safe, right?
So but it's almost like vigilantism, because I was telling you earlier when I was growing up, in the White Grove, yeah. I remember one of my neighbors, they got robbed, and my friend came out and said, "Oh, my dad took care of him." And I said, "What do you mean he took care of him?" He said he just went around the back and chopped him in the back of the legs with a cutlass.
Yeah,
and then watched the man run away, and then they found him in PMH and arrested him. But it was almost like, you come into my home.
Yeah.
I'm going to either shoot you or I'm going to protect my
right,
home.
And we have these very, American cultural sort of presets, if that's the word, you know, that don't really align with where we are. Like this idea of home ownership is so important. I have a house. And, yeah. But that's tied to autonomy, right? And adult maturity and autonomy is as a woman, I have my house and this is mine. But the average person can't afford a house. But culturally, we allow you to defend it to the death.
So that is quite American, isn't it, if you think about it?
Right.
You wouldn't see that even in Canada or in Europe, but that we're similar in that respect.
Well, okay, is that Biden calling? That ain't Biden calling, eh? We talk about it. With the mask mandate, that conversation, just this weekend, the federal government, a federal judge in Florida, ruled that the mask mandate, to end the mask mandates, right? And I was just thinking, we're so American in our thinking, in our way of being. Like, when are we going to end our mask mandates? Because almost as if we're following...
Well, I think the challenge is, because being a tourism destination, and guess where most of our tourists are coming from, the issue is, we just got downgraded or upgraded to status one.
Right.
And so we're going to do whatever it takes to, whatever the United States tells us to maintain that. And so whether you believe it's right or wrong, It's done out of economic necessity, right?
Why, and I wonder, why don't we have our own grading system, right? Like, okay, you're telling me, I read the minister's statements last week or earlier in March when the question of whether allowing tourists in the hotels, in certain parts of the hotels, to not wear masks is discrimination. And their response was essentially, our Emergency Operations Committee made a decision based on the vaccination rate of visitors in our hotels and the testing requirements to enter the country. Right? So that's like, that's why we're going to let the tourists and not Bahamians. So what I want to know is, when are we going to have a tiered system, right? Like, when are you going to tell us, create a standard? What is the criteria that we have to reach? Like, we have red, orange, yellow, green, and then I like blue skies, right? Blue skies mean everything cool. Everything is cool. And I wonder if, like, this removal of the mask mandate is blue skies, right? Or if it's green.
Yeah.
And when will we have a similar situation, a similar protocol for making these decisions ourselves?
But they wouldn't really make any difference because we're reliant on our visitors, right? So we have to be part of whatever that global criteria is.
Yeah.
But what's a shame to me is that when you look to Europe, you know, they've been, you know, you don't have to wear masks pretty much anywhere in a lot of European countries. In fact, even on, I know, four U.S. airlines, they've said no masks are required. So, you know, that seems to be, you know, we could maybe move faster. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, if you look at corporations in the States, they seem to already be demasking, but our businesses aren't.
Yeah.
And so whereas there seems to be a disconnect between what's happening in some parts of the States and what we're being mandated to do.
Yeah. Now, there has been some pushback, right? Mm-hmm. For instance, so the top four airlines, I think, have said that they're going to get rid of the mask mandate. But
not just voluntary.
A number of transit authorities, like Chicago, there's a huge transit authorities, like, hold on, we're not ready to give it up yet. Now, for me, I'm concerned, right? What I would have wanted to see before getting rid of the mask mandate is legislation requiring enhancement of air filtration system regulations, right? And protocols for the changing of air filters. Before the pandemic, every time I flew, I would have I would experience a sinus infection from dirty air on the airplane. Every single time. Right? And it didn't matter how many times I brought it to the airlines. It's a joke.
That, they have like the best filtration systems on those planes. That's amazing.
I mean, I would imagine, I would imagine that they have great ones, but it didn't matter every time. So I would expect to see that legislation locally, particularly for the hospital, for healthcare facilities, for walk-in clinics, a requirement, and concessions, right? Dropping the tax on it or the duty or whatever you can do to make that possible. So, I want to see some measures put in place. But is it that we're not going to drop our mask mandates and totally remove our restrictions until we've brought our hospital up to a particular capacity? And does that mean that we're always going to have mask mandates? I mean, I guess I'm being a little shady there, right?
Well, I'm thinking the thing that I don't really understand is why we're wearing them outside, because there doesn't seem to be very much evidence to show that, you know, the coronavirus is transmitted outside. In fact, you know, when you look at the data, the best places to be in your garden, on the beach, outside. So the idea of wearing a mask outside, I don't think is supported by science, or not any science that I've seen. So I think you could at least, you know, drop that aspect of it.
But the only thing I could think about is the inability to control proximity to other people in some public spaces. For instance, what I have found is that not only have people just forgotten that there's like a social distancing protocol in New Providence, but if you even wordlessly, if you just show that you are making space, people become offended. And I've seen physical aggression even.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's voluntary. If you're fearful of the coronavirus, then go and wear a mask. Do whatever you need to do that you feel will protect yourself. And you know, if you're going to be fearful, then please wear a mask, because, you know, not everyone's going to, you know, mm-hmm. observe those protocols.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, initially when I traveled, I avoided wearing masks because of the stigma of wearing masks, and sort of stigma with Chinese people wearing masks all the time.
And they were the only people that used to wear it until the coronavirus came along. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it looked kind of odd. You know, you used to see on the Japanese underground, they were...
Yeah. Scared. And I was concerned, you know, I was concerned that somebody in immigration is going to pull, or border control to be like, listen, miss, do you need a health screening? Like, we're not sure we're going to let you enter the country.
Yeah. I mean, it also goes back to when you look at historically over the past 2 years, you know, Western governments look to China for the policy. You know, when we look at the masking, we look at the lockdowns, those were Chinese things. And they came from a different type of culture, more authoritarian culture. And I think a lot of the Western countries we can see now, they were looking to China as a way of, here's a way that we could potentially control our citizens. And 2 years ago, we would have never put up with it. But then when that virus came along, we've kind of put up with it now. Mm-hmm. And I think we've crossed that line where I don't know if we're ever going to get back to where we were before.
Well, listen, I know we're almost out of time, right?
Okay.
I just mentioned this. I saw a disturbing video purporting to come out of China, of a city on lockdown.
Yeah.
With remember the robot dogs from Black Mirror?
Yeah, oh my God. That,
with a robot dog with a speaker
gives
on
me
it. Did you see that video?
And then, oh, that was insane. It still gives me
right.
kind of
I don't
want to
believe it, right?
It.
I don't want to believe it. Because it's just like watching Black Mirror.
Yeah.
But then I remember China has already implemented a social credit rating mm-hmm. system, which is also from Black Mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I'm waiting for, like I tell you...
The trouble is our governments are getting all excited about doing the same thing to their populations. It's very
No, sir. First of all, Bahamian government can't afford robot dogs. They can't afford robot dogs. They can't afford to do regular tabulations at NIB. They cannot afford robot dogs. And then just in case nobody ever told them...
And in servicing, you got to service those robot dogs,
I rebuke that in the name of every Chichani that ever was born in the beautiful Bahamas. And not to be sort of revolutionary, you know. But I think sometimes you just need to have a firm word with people and let them know that you don't have the moral authority. You barely have the moral authority to govern at this point. It's 2022. And I'd be in dead serious with that. Right? You're talking about NIB is going to run out by 2029? And we don't have a comprehensive plan yet. You could start just by how much pay cut you're going to take to put in the kitty. And so I just, as a human rights advocate, I want to say this. Just remember, y'all can't afford to even rent no robot dog, let alone buy robot dog. Again, another text here said, these guys will say anything to protect tourism, literally at risk of Bahamians dying. They will force you to inject unknown substances in your body. They will not, because they will not pay for it. I'm telling you, they're not going to waste money on that. It's better things to do with their money. But in 2021, D'Aguilar literally said there was no evidence that COVID was related to tourist travel. And with people, okay, yeah, don't even call that by name. Dear Texter, you send me down a rabbit hole. I got to pull myself up out of it. I hope you see me on the camera. Yeah, that music? Thank you, producer. Boy, Texter, anyway, this is the World News Tuesday. We're talking about mask mandates, gun ownership, and gun control. And what's been going on in the Bahamas. Mark, thank you for joining me this morning. And dear Bahamas, while we all have the right to a life free of violence, and we certainly have a right to protect ourselves, I'm not quite sure if we all have the right to own a gun quite yet, including me. That's why I don't have one. Have a blessed day, Bahamas. Thank you, Mark. Stay tuned. Guardian Radio AM is up next.
Tell me why, first of all, what's the big deal? Just a few black boys with some blue steel running round in circles just to get a square meal. But as a normal scene, let's just keep it real, 'cause everybody's selling.